more human, socially engaged, and modernizing Buddhism. Starting in the 1920s, he urged monks to go toward the people, to tailor Buddhism to their needs and to those of the nation. The clergy had to energize the church through compassion and social action, he insisted. This could be done through the creation of charitable and relief organizations to help the poor, the orphaned, and the hungry, through the building of religious schools to train novices in the way of the Buddha, and via the establishment of clinics to heal the sick. Reform, Taizu said, also depended on creating a streamlined monastic order, or sangha. Only a modern church could train, control, and administer such a renewed religion at the national level. He discussed all of this in scores of lectures, books, and articles published in China and among the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia. Indeed, thanks to Chinese bookstores in Indochina, Vietnamese monks, many of them still quite capable of reading Chinese characters, procured Taizu's writings and translated scores of Chinese Buddhist publications into Quoc Ngu. Taizu's program struck many Vietnamese Buddhists and young reform-minded monks as highly relevant to the situation in Indochina. Monks like Thich Nhat Hanh Do Nam Thu and Thien Chu embraced Taizu's ideas and began promoting his reforms in a bid to respond to and make sense of the rapid transformation of Vietnamese society and the chronic suffering in the countryside. They found inspiration and models in Taizu's seminal text, The Reorganization of the Sangha System, 1915. These efforts and others bore fruit during the interwar period, which was symbolized by the establishment of new Buddhist associations, the first for Cochin China in 1931, the second in Annam a year later, and a third in Tonkin in 1934, each theoretically in charge of provincial chapters. Vietnamese Buddhists developed a host of relief and charity organizations, many of which helped during the Great Famine of 1944-5. Hundreds of religious schools appeared to train a new generation of monks and nuns in the correct Buddhist canon and practices. Although this restructuring was admittedly easier said than done, by the 1930s, a unified and increasingly structured Buddhist church emerged in Vietnam. Reformers established the Quan Su Temple near the train station in Hanoi, which rapidly became the hub for Buddhism reformism. It is today the home of the Vietnamese National Buddhist Congregation. The French tolerated many of these efforts as long as they remained apolitical, but never had the means in any case to stop their growth locally. Women played a particularly important role in the development of Buddhism in 20th century Vietnam, as they had earlier. They contributed money and donated land to open new monasteries and schools. Many ran the charity organizations. Buddhist schools trained more nuns than ever before in Vietnamese history. The northern nun, Huy Tam, was an ardent supporter of the Buddhist reform movement. In 1935, Nguyen Thai Hai traveled to India to participate in a major Buddhist congress. The renewal of Buddhism was also linked to wider debates over the role of women in the church and in society, and the need to create a national and socially sensitive church. Indeed, the revitalization of Buddhism provided the rural poor with a powerful message of liberation and salvation, making it a socio-political force with which to reckon. The Hoa Hao and Cao Dai Faiths of the Mekong Delta. This was particularly true in the Mekong Delta, where Buddhist messianism was at its strongest and had long mixed with a tradition of peasant millennialism and mysticism to produce breakaway schools of faith. Besides being a mosaic of peoples, cultures, and religions, the Southern Delta had also long been a colonial society where the Nguyen had promoted large-scale private landlordism and plantations. The Nguyen accorded concessions to soldiers and loyal elites who, in return, would help the imperial hub of power, Wei, control these newly conquered territories. However, this concentration of commercial rice land in the hands of the few also meant that peasant landlessness ran high as the population increased, and, with it, the potential for social discontent. In the early 1840s, the acting financial commissioner for the province of Vinh Long informed the emperor that 70% to 80% of the villagers in his province were landless. If families in the Red River Delta could turn to communal lands in times of difficulty and owned more than one half of the available farmland there, such publicly shared lands were largely absent in Cochin China, and farmers owned only one-third of the land in the south. Peasant misery existed elsewhere in Vietnam, to be sure, but when hunger became unbearable in the south, spurring local leaders to action, it did so within a unique socio-cultural context. Self-proclaimed holy men often appeared at this time, as they did in Thailand, Burma, and Cambodia. Several evoked the name of the Buddha Messiah, Maitreya, in order to rally the famished behind them. This savior would create a new kingdom and put an end to suffering on earth. These millenarian machines also mobilized religious support for imminently socio-economic demands, the reduction of taxes, the free sale of agricultural produce, or the cancellation of rural debts. With tens of thousands of desperate peasants standing behind them, they could force the ruling class to listen. In the late 1840s, in the midst of a massive cholera epidemic that killed perhaps as many as 1 million people, a mystic in the Delta, Don Minh Huynh, initiated a millenarian movement known as the Dao Bu Song Ki Huang, the Way of the Strange Fragrance from the Precious Mountain. Huynh cast himself as a living Buddha, a Maitreya, sent into the world to end suffering and to bring salvation. Crowds flocked to hear him. Many attributed supernatural powers to him. Others said he could heal the sick. Like the Taiping Rebellion threatening to bring down the Qing dynasty in the 1850s to make way for the Heavenly Kingdom, this precious mountain movement worried the court profoundly and pointed up the volatility of the Mekong Delta in times of profound socioeconomic crisis. The French did little to alleviate the landlessness problem in the south, where they expanded the plantation system on an unprecedented scale, as discussed before in this chapter, nor did the southern population remain unchanged. It increased from 1.7 million in 1880 to 4.4 million in 1930. Unsurprisingly, the French also had to confront religious mystics leading revolts and trying to build religious kingdoms on waves of peasant anger surging across the Delta. Between 1911 and 1913, a southern mystic, Phan Xích Long, launched an intermittent millenarian rebellion near Saigon Chalon. He claimed to be the descendant of the rebel emperor, Ham Nhi, whom the French had shipped out of the country in the late 1880s. He simultaneously cast himself as the living Buddha. He and others like him found support among the rural poor, landless peasants, and disgruntled civil servants. The Phan Xích Long rebellion, though easily smashed, served as a warning to the authorities that these millenarian, mystic-minded leaders could mobilize tens of thousands of people. And these living Buddhas were not as backward or as foul, mad, as secular, colonial, nationalist, and communist elites often painted them. They, too, knew how to tap into modern organizational techniques, print media, and use Quoc Nhu to spread their message. This was certainly true of the Cao Dai faith, founded by Lý Văn Trung in 1926. Trung inspired a group of Vietnamese civil servants, landowners, and peasants who were attracted by his messianic message. The two words Cao Dai evoke in Vietnamese the supreme or elevated being, which brings peace, harmony, and salvation to the world. It is called the Dai Dao Tam Ki Pho Do, which translates officially as the Way of the Highest Power. This belief system is hierarchically structured and based organizationally on the model of the Roman Catholic Church. A Ho Pháp, Pope, leads the Cao Dai Church, with its Holy See based in Thái Ninh Province, located on the Cambodian border. Like reformist Buddhism, Cao Dai leaders embraced a progressive program calling for greater equality between men and women, closer relations between the landowning and peasant classes, and the belief that colonization was punishment for failing to follow core Cao Dai teachings now located in a faraway past. Pham Khong Thach, a civil servant in Phnom Penh, resigned his post in 1928 and returned to Tainan, the cradle of the religion, to help Trung run the rapidly expanding faith. Following Trung's death in 1935, Pham Khong Thak extended his influence and, in 1938, became the movement's supreme spiritual leader. The Cao Thai faith's embrace of the mystic and the ritualistic attracted a large following in the South. It also tapped into pre-existing religions inside Vietnam, borrowed from foreign ones, and combined them all into a unique faith symbolized by the left eye of God open within the Cao Thai triangle. The French closely monitored the rapid development of the Cao Thai faith, worried by its social alliances, politicization, and its ability to garner massive support in the countryside. With extraordinary speed, the Cao Thai Church counted between 500,000 and 1 million believers. Out of a total Cochin Chinese population of 4.4 million people. During the Second World War, Pham Khong Thak welcomed the chance to expand the faith thanks to the Japanese occupation and the change in the balance of power this promised. Worried by just such a scenario, the French first incarcerated Pham Khong Thak in Vietnam and then shipped him off to Madagascar. This did not stop the expansion of the faith, and following the Japanese overthrow of the French in March 1945, Cao Thai leaders mobilized their armed militias and entered the fray of nationalist politics when the Japanese capitulated a few months later. Another faith to emerge in the Mekong Delta was that of the Hoa Hao. In July 1939, Hoeng Phu So, a 19-year-old from the village of Hoa Hao in Chau Dok province, revealed during the course of a mystic experience that he was a Buddhist holy man. His mastery of Buddhist teachings impressed all. His charisma was, by all accounts, electrifying. Those present spoke of his supernatural powers, serenity, and compassion. Even the meaning of his native village, Hoa Hao, conciliation or concord, seemed to confirm the legitimacy of this young man with the piercing eyes and the message he revealed. Two other factors also allowed him to expand what could have remained a localized cult into a major southern faith. Firstly, he could draw upon local Buddhist beliefs and the centuries-old popularity of the Maitreya Buddha to renew the millenarian promise of a coming golden age. Secondly, like Pham Khong Thak, Hoeng Phu So could tap into real rural discontent among the landless and unemployed masses, many of whom were looking for a savior and the promise of a better world to help them make it through the difficult economic times of the 1930s. Hoeng Phu So was less interested in building a structured church like that of the Catholics, Cao Thai, Mahayana Buddhists, or communists. He emphasized, rather, the pure spiritual core of Hoa Hao Buddhism, Phat Yao Hoa Hao. This also makes it harder to know just how many people joined him. By the time the Japanese started moving into northern Indochina in 1940, the French estimated that Hoeng Phu So had several thousand followers concentrated in the provinces of Tan Chau, Chau Dok, and Long Zuyin. The French thought him crazy and interned the Bronze Phao, Mad Monk, in a psychiatric ward in Saigon, where he promptly converted his Vietnamese doctor to the faith. What really worried the French were the Japanese, who successfully intercepted So during his transfer to Laos and protected him from French arrest. By March 1945, when French Indochina collapsed under the Japanese, the Hoa Hao faith counted around 100,000 believers, several thousand of whom he had already begun organizing into militias. Unlike the communists, whose failed uprising in 1940 ended in almost complete destruction, the combined Hoa Hao and Cao Thai forces emerged from the Second World War as major politico-military actors, controlling together perhaps as much as 20% of the Delta's total population. Catholic Vietnam. Vietnamese Catholicism also changed greatly during the colonial period. From the 16th century on, seaborne trading routes opened by the Iberians had debarked thousands of European missionaries in Asia. By the late 17th century, around 100,000 Vietnamese, mainly concentrated in the north, had converted to Catholicism. These numbers increased slowly over the years as Catholicism spread southward into the Mekong Delta with the Nguyen. In 1945, out of a total population of around 30 million people, 1.6 million Vietnamese were Catholics. There were undoubtedly very real problems and mistrust between Catholics and their secular rulers from the time of the 16th century onward. As we saw, European missionaries and many Vietnamese Catholics did indeed look to the French for help against Minh Mang's attack on them. However, this does not mean that colonial and Catholic interests were identical, or that this early collaborative relationship between missionaries and colonizers remained static until 1945. The Vietnamese church changed greatly between Napoleon III's conquest of Cochin China in 1862 and Ho Chi Minh's declaration of the independence of Vietnam in 1945. The relationship between French missionaries and the French colonial rulers in Indochina also changed. Napoleon III might have been a fervent Catholic, and that's debatable, but his Republican successors were anything of the sort. By the turn of the century, almost all of the French administrators in Indochina were secularist-minded, anti-clerical products of the Third Republic. Paul Doumer and many other high-ranking colonial administrators like him were Freemasons. Albert Serrault was a leading member of the Radical Socialist Party, a Dreyfusard, and an ardent supporter of the laws separating church and state in France at the turn of the century. While it would be wrong to conclude that all Republican administrators necessarily became the enemies of Catholics in the empire, the alert ones realized upon their arrival overseas how hard it would be to adhere to Leon Gambetta's warning in 1876 that anti-clericalism should not be exported to the empire. Many a zealous Republican journalist, educator, lower-ranking officer, and civilian administrator remembered Gambetta best for his call to arms against the French Catholic clergy, "Le clericalisme, voilà l'ennemi." Rather than seeing the missionaries as allies in building colonial Indochina, many considered them unpatriotic and disloyal. Several were convinced that these Roman Catholic missionaries threatened the Third Republic's special civilizing mission in Indochina. Colonial officials, police services, and anti-clerical journalists kept close tabs on missionary publications, proselytizing efforts, and connections with the Vatican and other Asian churches, especially in China and the Philippines. French missionaries, most of whom still operated under the Mission Etrangère de Paris, realized that they had to keep on good terms with colonial administrators if they were to keep their church up and running. The countryside, where the missions had always been most active, was the main site of conflict between the colonial state and the Catholic missions. On several occasions, local administrators concluded that they could not trust some missionaries to serve as the intermediaries for administering faraway territories and peoples. While colonial officials appreciated the impressive knowledge, contacts, and languages the European missionaries could marshal, they just as often doubted their political loyalty. Léopold Sabatier, a dedicated French civil servant working among the Rédé people in the highlands, intensely distrusted French priests and their Vietnamese faithful. They were, in his view, unfit to administer territories in the highlands. In another instance, one French priest responded to his critics that he had always done his best to spread the Republican message into the highlands, and in so doing had brought tens of thousands of non-Viet people into the colonial fold. And many French priests did support the colonial project, but when attacked for failing to teach French to their Vietnamese followers, some missionaries lost patience. Standing before the Cochin Chinese Colonial Council, one Father Mossad declared, "Dare I add that the Vietnamese who know French are, with rare exception, those who love the French the least, who respect them the least, and who, fundamentally, are the most hostile to them?" Furious, one of the ethnic Viet Republicans sitting on the council shot back that this was an attack on all Vietnamese who, like me, received the benefits of French civilization. "Monsieur Mossad clearly is accusing us of being traitors." Not quite, but the French priest should have held his tongue, for the council revoked his subsidy. As for not teaching French, it had nothing to do with missionary anti-republicanism or insufficient French nationalism. What counted most for religious leaders in Vietnam was spreading the word of God in Vietnamese and other languages besides French. Buddhists, Cao Daists, Hoa Hao, nationalists, communists, and even Pierre Pasquier understood this. However, the colonial republic's problems with Catholicism came less from the French missionaries than from Vietnamese Catholics and the Vatican in Rome. Like those pursuing other religions, a growing number of Vietnamese Catholics asserted their desire to take control of their church and grow it on their terms and in their language. The rise of print culture, increased literacy in Quoc Ngu, and expanding roads and improved transportation facilitated this. Catholic papers, pamphlets, and booklets flourished during the interwar period, mainly printed in Quoc Ngu. Reinvigorated religious instruction produced a new generation of indigenous priests and nuns, while the expansion of Catholic schools helped spread the faith among the younger generations. Although Vietnamese priests were, as a rule, hostile to communism, progressive trends in global Catholicism, France, and Indochina led to a more socially conscious, center-left brand of Catholicism, as clergy and lay people organized youth, workers, and peasants into associations. And as for other faiths, nationalism was very much a part of this religious transformation of Vietnamese Catholicism. To French dismay, a handful of Vietnamese priests like Father Mai Lao Bang in Nghi An province helped the Vietnamese patriot Pham Boi Chau in the early 1900s organize the dispatch of young men to Japan to study and drive out the French. The French were equally troubled by their inability to stop Vietnamese Catholics from moving within a wider Roman Catholic world in search of new ideas, models, and sources of international support. Indeed, the Vatican was a real problem for French republicans well into the 1950s. Particularly worrying was Rome's decision after the First World War to distance the Catholic Church from colonialism. Faced with an increasingly secular Europe, papal strategists concluded that the center of gravity of Catholicism was shifting rapidly toward the non-Western world, and with it, the future of the Church. Reports of colonial abuses in European empires and the association of European missionaries with Western colonialism convinced religious authorities that it was imperative to indigenize the non-Western Church. Just as worrisome was the rise of communism in a new state spanning all of Eurasia, the Soviet Union. The creation of the Comintern, the Communist International Organization, in 1919, which preached a new type of universal secularism, reinforced the Vatican's willingness to change its global tack. And, of course, the accelerating de-Christianization of Western Europe only reinforced the Church's interest in the non-Western world. The Vatican moved with surprising alacrity. Benedict XV's 1919 apostolic letter, Maximum Illud, and Pius XI's 1926 encyclical Rerum Ecclesiae authorized the indigenization of the Church in the non-Western world. Rome's emissaries immediately informed local European missionaries in China, Vietnam, and elsewhere that they should prepare to turn over the Church to the local clergy and support the efforts mentioned before to invigorate a Vietnamese Catholic Church. In Vietnam, this meant the training, designation, and ordination of local bishops. Despite colonial and even European missionary resistance, Rome successfully dispatched an apostolic delegate to Indochina in 1925 to preside over the Vietnamization of the Church there. French Republican leaders could do little to stop the Vatican. On the one hand, who among them could seriously accuse the Pope of being pro-communist? On the other hand, the Third Republic's all-out secular assault on the Church's powers and property in France removed any leverage French leaders might have used to make Rome toe the colonial line. As Rome's new delegate wrote in the late 1920s, "Times having evolved, indigenous priests must be second to none to extend more effectively the kingdom of Christ. This is not what French Republican colonialists wanted to hear. In effect, the Vatican was implementing a genuine policy of association by letting the Vietnamese run their own church in collaboration with Rome. This was precisely the type of colonial policy Vietnamese moderates wanted, and the French had been promising since the regime of Governor-General Paul Bo, but had never implemented. Sereau had raised hopes enormously after 1918, but nothing tangible had come of French association. While the Catholic Church and its elite remained heavily Eurocentric, sometimes racist, and almost always paternalistic, the Vatican's indigenous policy trapped French Republicans in their own discourse and inertia. French authorities were anything but elated in 1933 when Pope Pius XI ordained Nguyen Ba Thong as its first Vietnamese bishop in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. Thong returned to a hero's welcome in Vietnam. Newspapers splashed his picture on their front pages. Even non-Christian Vietnamese expressed pride in Rome's decision to trust one of them. As the French ambassador to the Vatican wrote perceptively in a 1933 dispatch, "We would have difficulties making the Vatican understand our opposition to the elevation of one of our colonial subjects to ecclesiastic honors and episcopal functions. We present ourselves voluntarily as the most liberal of colonizers. The expression indigenous politics and politics of association come from us. How could we justify finding this to be a poor method simply because it is the Vatican that is applying it?" Confronted with massive revolts and the rise of communism in China and Vietnam, colonial authorities watched helplessly as Rome proceeded to indigenize the Vietnamese Catholic Church before their eyes. Ironically, the Pope was better at implementing a form of association in Vietnam than the French Third Republic was. Significantly, support for the indigenization of Catholicism and the application of indigenous rule to Vietnam's Catholic Church came from influential Catholics at the court in Hue, most notably from Nguyen Hu Bai and Ngo Dinh Ca. Both had accepted collaboration with the French on the understanding that the Protectorate Treaty would allow the monarchy to continue to administer and reform the country in association with the French, not on orders from them. They were aghast at the way the French had humiliated, dethroned, and exiled the rebel emperors Than Thai and Duy Tan. While it is unclear to what extent the two things were linked in their minds, Ca and Bai welcomed Rome's indigenization of the church and used it to increase pressure on the French to respect the Protectorate Treaty, which allowed indigenous rule via the monarchy. Ngo Dinh Ca had raised his children in this patriotic tradition, which had included Catholics as well as Buddhists. Upon the death of Ngo Dinh Ca in 1925, Nguyen Hu Bai took his friend's sons under his wing, Ngo Dinh Diem and Ngo Dinh Thuc. The Ngo brothers grew up in this patriotic milieu, one that was initially for the monarchy and pro-association. The revolts of the early 1930s changed French policy. Caught off guard by massive peasant uprisings and worried by the rise of Soviet-backed Vietnamese communism, Sereau and Pasquier agreed to let these royalists administer a new government in Annam, which would be more in accordance with the Protectorate Treaty. Pasquier also agreed to let their colonial monarch, Bao Dai, trained in France, return to run a protectorate government in Annam. With Nguyen Hu Bai's support, Ngo Dinh Diem joined Bao Dai's government in 1934. However, Pasquier rapidly changed his mind and ended the first Bao Dai solution when he realized that Bao Dai, Ngo Dinh Diem, and Nguyen Hu Bai were serious about administering indigenous affairs in line with the Protectorate Treaty. Angered by French bad faith and especially their attack on Bai, Diem resigned while Bao Dai withdrew from public affairs. Although Bao died before he could savor the moment, in 1938, another one of his adopted sons, Ngo Dinh Thuc, became a bishop. Tuck never hid his patriotic views and used the Vatican's support and policies to prod the French, when he could, to respect indigenous rule properly. More than anything else, the rise of the No Brothers in the 1930s symbolized the shift from the royalist patriotism of their fathers to the emergence of a strongly nationalist Catholicism involved in politics, whether the French or other Vietnamese liked it or not. While this Catholic anti-colonialism coexisted uneasily with the simultaneous emergence of Vietnamese communism during the 1930s, Vietnamese Catholics, Buddhists, Cao Dai supporters, Hoa Hao followers, and others shared one thing in common with the communists: the desire to secure the country's full independence. We should thus not be surprised that they were all elated when Ho Chi Minh stepped before the crowd in Hanoi on the 2nd of September 1945 to declare Vietnam's independence. On the 1st of November 1945, one of Vietnam's rising Catholic stars from Phat Diem, Ly Hu Tu, was ordained as a bishop without the interference of colonial administrators or the presence of a single European missionary. Intensely anti-colonialist, Ly Hu Tu joined Bao Dai and Pham Cong Thach in accepting Ho Chi Minh's invitation to serve as a supreme advisor to the new national government. Like the communists, Buddhists, Hoa Hao followers, Cao Dai supporters, and Catholics were also nationalists. Chapter 7. Contesting Empires and Nation-States. The 2nd of September 1945 was a hot, muggy day in Saigon. Starting in the morning, a well-known southern radical, Tran Van Giao, tried his best to preside over a massive demonstration of 200,000 people to celebrate Vietnam's independence declaration. The participants included men and women, young and old, rich and poor, workers and civil servants. Starting on the outskirts of town, they all converged on Norodom Square in downtown Saigon. The highlight of the day was scheduled for the afternoon, when loudspeakers would broadcast live Ho Chi Minh's address to the nation, which would announce the creation of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, DRV, and its Declaration of Independence. The organizers had also learned earlier that day that the first Allied teams were about to arrive to accept the Japanese surrender. Men and women immediately plastered the town square with banners and posters reading in English, Chinese, and Russian, "Down with fascism and colonialism. Vietnam has suffered and bled under the French yoke. Long live the USSR and the USA," and "Long live Vietnamese independence." British, Chinese, American, Russian flags and the DRV's red one, with a yellow star in the middle, hung from administrative buildings. The French tricolor was conspicuously absent. The French were not among the Allied powers authorized to accept the Japanese defeat. Powerful emotions mixing nationalist invincibility and colonial insecurity were swirling all over Saigon that day. Dozens of French families watched with fear and curiosity from their balconies as the Vietnamese poured into the square below them to chant independent slogans. But the crowd's playful exuberance suddenly turned into anger when the organizers failed to broadcast Ho's independence speech from Hanoi. Some muttered that it was colonial sabotage, as others began to eye the French staring down from above. Then, as the crowd began to disperse, shots rang out. French and Vietnamese both ran for cover as pandemonium seized the square. Some hot-headed Vietnamese attacked French houses and fired on the nearby cathedral as the DRV security forces tried, with little success, to maintain order. A dozen French people perished in the violence, including a French priest known for his charitable work among the poor of Saigon. During the entire time, the armed Japanese sentries and soldiers looking on from the sidelines did little to maintain order in a country they had ruled throughout the Second World War. They refused to free the French soldiers they had vanquished a few months earlier. and now defeated themselves, they refused to take orders from anyone but the Allies. Two shattered empires were on display on that hot Saigon day for all to see, one French, the other Japanese. And no one knew, as Ho Chi Minh declared Vietnam's independence in Hanoi, what would come next. Would the new French, freed from the German imperial grip in Europe, be able to empathize with the aspirations for independence of their former colonial subjects? Or would Free France's Charles de Gaulle insist upon reasserting his country's own colonial domination to erase the humiliating defeat of 1940 and thus reinforce France's own national identity, international prestige, and economic recovery? Global War and the Fall of Two Empires. The French and Japanese were not fated to clash over control of Indochina. Despite Japan's military victory over the Russians in 1905 and French fears of a Pereira Jeune, both countries had normalized their diplomatic relations in 1909 following Japan's expulsion of Phan Boi Chau's Go East movement and the latter's recognition of French sovereignty over Indochina. In return, Paris had no trouble recognizing Japan's colonization of Korea in 1910 and membership in the Great Powers Club. Japan's entry into the First World War on the side of the Allies kept relations on an even keel, as did its post-war participation in the League of Nations and collective security arrangements in the Asia-Pacific region. All that changed in the late 1920s. With the advent of the Great Depression and the rise to power of an authoritarian military class, Japan's relative political and economic liberalism vanished rapidly. The country's new military leaders abandoned collective security and engagement in the international system, convinced that the country's survival depended on renewed colonial expansion and going it alone in Asia as depression-driven tariff barriers went up around the world. In making this choice, however, militarists put their country on a collision course with the Western imperial powers in Asia, not just the French, but also the Europeans and Americans. China, however, bore the immediate brunt of renewed Japanese colonial aggression. As Chiang Kai-shek's army advanced northward from its southern stronghold to defeat warlords opposed to the creation of a unified China, strategists in Tokyo concluded that they had to attack before China could consolidate. In 1931, as the French crushed anti-colonial revolts in Indochina, the Japanese army invaded mineral-rich Manchuria. When the League of Nations objected, Tokyo withdrew its membership in order to continue its colonial offensive. In 1937, the international community looked on as the Japanese Imperial Army invaded China, took control of the coastline running to the Indochinese border, and pushed Chiang Kai-shek's Republican government into southwestern China. This occurred against the backdrop of the emergence in 1933 of another expansionist-minded authoritarian state on the other side of the Eurasian continent, Nazi Germany. And just as the Japanese sought to create a new order in Asia, the Nazis wanted to do much the same in Europe. 2 years after the Japanese invasion of China, the Germans set Europe ablaze by attacking Poland. The French were no more prepared to go to war with the Japanese over Indochina than they were capable of defending France against the Germans. In June 1940, the French capitulated to the Germans, while the majority of Republican deputies, including figures such as Albert Soreau, signed over full powers to Marshal Philippe Pétain. The Third Republic was dead. In its place, Pétain assumed the leadership of the French state, better known as Vichy France, named for the town from which it soon operated. The Vietnamese had confronted superior French power in the mid-19th century, and now the French found themselves in a similar situation. Many resisted the Germans, notably Charles de Gaulle, who fled to London, then on to Algiers following the Allied liberation of North Africa in late 1942. Most kept their heads down, while others saw a chance to promote revolutionary projects which had been marginalized under decades of Republican rule. In October 1940, for example, Pétain promoted a policy of collaboration with Hitler and initiated the National Revolution, which included the termination of democratic politics, the reinvigoration of the Catholic Church, and the promotion of authoritarian rule based on agrarian identity politics. Work, family, and country became the famous slogan. Mass propaganda drives, youth mobilization campaigns, and a cult of personality centered on the grandfatherly Pétain sought to inculcate such values. Meanwhile, authorities adopted anti-Semitic laws and took a hard line toward the left. Like his predecessors, Pétain attached great importance to the empire, both strategically and ideologically. However, the exportation of the National Revolution to Indochina was complicated by the fact that the French were not the only ones in charge. The Japanese had been following European events closely, keen to take control of the Indochinese overland and maritime bridge to Southeast Asia. Control of the Red River Delta, its routes, and the railway running from Hanoi to Kunming would allow Tokyo to further cut off Chiang Kai-shek's government in Yunnan province from international suppliers. Worried by Japanese assault on China, the Americans and the Soviets had already increased their support of the besieged Chinese Republic and warned the Japanese not to strike into Tonkin, keenly aware of the geopolitical importance of Vietnam. In a complex series of events which began with the French capitulation to the Nazis in June 1940, ushering in the new Vichy government, Germany's Axis ally, Tokyo, put pressure on the French authorities in Hanoi to allow Japanese troops to enter Tonkin. In July, the new French authorities named Admiral Jean de Caux Governor-General of Indochina, instructing him to maintain French sovereignty over the colony. In the fall, as Pétain moved France closer to Germany, de Caux received orders to allow the Japanese to station 6,000 troops in Tonkin. In exchange, the Japanese recognized French sovereignty over Indochina. French collaboration with Nazi Germany, Tokyo's main Axis partner from September 1940, opened the way to a troubled but unique imperial condominium in Indochina, in which two imperial powers, one Asian, the other European, now ruled. At the heart of this dual arrangement was the Japanese preference to administer Indochina indirectly through the French in order that they might focus on more important military matters. Despite their shared anti-communism, disgust for democracy, and antipathy for the Anglo-Americans, right-wing French and Japanese rulers were reluctant and distrustful allies. Clashes between their troops were always a real possibility. De Caux saw little to emulate in the Japanese ideologically and did everything in his power to maintain French sovereignty and promote the National Revolution to the detriment of Japan's greater co-prosperity sphere and pan-Asiatic propaganda. But, as in Europe, French territory in Indochina was in reality under foreign occupation. De Caux got his first taste of this when the Japanese supported the Thais in their phony war against the French over control of western Indochina, stepping in to ensure that Bangkok won despite a French naval victory. In May 1941, left with no choice but armed resistance and the possibility of losing Indochina entirely, De Caux ceded large swaths of western Cambodia and Laos to Thai expansionists, and in so doing undermined the territorial integrity of French Indochina. The Japanese also secured a new agreement with the French, which placed the rest of the colony under Tokyo's military jurisdiction. The Japanese could now station 75,000 troops in southern Indochina. They also administered monetary policy and extracted rice and natural resources there with the collaboration of French authorities and the Bank of Indochina. Alarmed by Japan's expansion into Southeast Asia via Vietnam, President Franklin D. Roosevelt responded by freezing Japanese assets in the United States and led an embargo against Tokyo. The Japanese replied by preparing a surprise attack on the American naval forces in the Pacific in order to expand further southward in search of oil and rubber. Meanwhile, the Germans prepared to strike eastward deep into Eurasia's midsection. Following the German invasion of the Soviet Union in June 1941, the Japanese attacked the American Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor in December and moved into all of Southeast Asia. The Americans entered the war, focusing first on Europe as the Japanese used their Indochinese bases to overthrow the British in Malaya, December 1941, Singapore, February 1942, and Burma, January through May 1942. American rule in the Philippines came to an end during December 1941 to May 1942, as did Dutch control over Indonesia by March 1942. Vietnam was now part of a world at war, carrying with it the seeds of great historical change and terrible human suffering. Vichy's collaboration was essential to Tokyo's ability to rule Indochina. As long as the French honored their mutual agreements and provided the required food, labor, and natural resources, Japanese authorities were content to rule indirectly through the pre-existing colonial administration. Decoe both signed authorizations for and approved rice transfers to the Japanese and reported to them. It is uncertain, however, if the French grasped how some 15,000 Indochinese elite members and millions of increasingly hungry peasants may have interpreted such joint colonial collaboration. Firstly, while Decoe prided himself on keeping Indochina French despite foreign occupation, just as Pétain claimed to do in the metropole, it was clear to any thinking Indochinese that he did so because the Japanese allowed him to do so. Secondly, that a yellow race could so easily dominate a white one debunked for good social Darwinian arguments which had often been used to justify European colonial rule. Vietnamese rickshaw driver serving customers in Saigon would have understood that the Japanese soldier strolling down Rue Katina had upended the colonial order and the racist assumptions on which it rested. Thirdly, by collaborating with the Japanese, the French failed to honor duly signed international legal agreements binding them to defend their Asian colony. For the Vietnamese, who were accustomed to repeated legal arguments justifying colonial rule, the failure to honor this contract ruined the legitimacy of colonial claims and later French attempts to reassert them. The Japanese left equally negative impressions. Despite all the talk of liberating the Asian yellow people from Western white colonial exploitation since the days of Meiji, the undeniable truth was that the Japanese colonialists had intentionally left the white man in power in Indochina. By choosing to rule Indochina through the French, the Japanese even abandoned their most loyal Vietnamese allies in their hour of greatest need. When diehard lieutenants of Phan Boi Chau's Go East program tried to seize power in the fall of 1940, the Japanese let the French crush them rather than help the nationalists. Tokyo even refused to put their longtime ally, Prince Quang De, on the throne in Hue, preferring not to disrupt the existing monarchy under Bao Dai and to risk undermining stability in Indochina. Quang De died in Japan in 1951, a bitter and abandoned man. Worst of all, Japanese rule triggered a famine that would kill over a million Vietnamese peasants by 1945. In Indochina, the so-called co-prosperity sphere, the term had been coined by the Japanese imperial government to describe a bloc of Asian nations which were to be led by them, was riddled with contradictions. The same was true for French efforts to promote their national revolution in Indochina. Admiral Jean Decoe faithfully applied anti-Semitic laws and clamped down on Republicans and their associations in Indochina, Freemasons, the League of Human Rights, and the Popular Front. In their place, he promoted the fascist-minded French Legion of Soldiers and Volunteers for the National Revolution, Légion Française des Combattants et Volontaires de la Révolution Nationale. Thanks to volunteers from the European settler community, its ranks increased from 2,637 members in early 1942 to 6,576 by mid-1943, meaning about 25% of the total European population. Although some Vietnamese admired Hitler and dabbled with fascism, there is no evidence that Vichy authorities or activists sought to incorporate such right-wing Vietnamese nationalists into their fascist-minded Legion. Vichy did little of substance to break down the racially configured colonial divide between rulers and ruled. Vichy did roll back what little democracy the Third Republic had introduced to Indochina. Upon his arrival, de Gaulle rescinded those popular front reforms which had been designed to increase the democratic participation of local indigenous councillors in the municipal assemblies of Saigon, Hanoi, and Haiphong. He now simply appointed people to those positions. In November 1940, de Gaulle presided over the dissolution of all Indochinese assemblies, including the Colonial Council of Cochin China. Although de Gaulle dusted off Thoreau's idea of creating an Indochinese federation, he gutted it of any remaining liberalism. The Federal Indochinese Council, created in mid-1941, relied exclusively on staunchly pro-French notables, all 25 of whom the governor named. The Japanese never required any of these anti-democratic measures. In 1943, de Gaulle justified his policy in terms fully in line with metropolitan, Vichy, France, authoritarianism. No doubt on the French side, some beneficiaries of the old regime will regret seeing their opportunities for democratic machinations disappear. But the wholesome element will accept with satisfaction a reform marking the government's desire to apply to Indochina the principles used to restore our patrie. None of those who recognize the dangers of elections can interpret this reform as a regression. On the Indochinese side, the evolved Indochinese element, in other words, the key to indigenous opinion, has embraced wholeheartedly the principles of the National Revolution, and never had any delusions about the powers of former assemblies in the first place. This was woefully inaccurate. By brushing aside a half-century of Vietnamese calls for meaningful representation in decision-making, de Gaulle further alienated a wide section of the Vietnamese elite, including the pro-French constitutionalists like Bui Quang Chu. Hounded by the police, younger Republicans like Nguyen Thuong Tham fled to China to join the Vietnamese Nationalist Party. A few elected to work with the Japanese. The politically minded leaders of the Hoa Hao and Cao Dai religious faiths, Hoin Phu So and Pham Cong Thach, used Japanese power and protection to politicize, mobilize, and eventually arm their followers, something which the French had tried to block for years. The only Vietnamese card de Gaulle would consider was the one his predecessors had been using for decades, the monarchy, and its indefatigable Vietnamese defender, Pham Coyne. In 1942, this man published a front-page article in the newspaper La Patrie Annamite, the Annamese Nation, which embraced the royalist ideas of French fascist Charles Marat. Coyne insisted that Vietnam had to return to its traditional Confucian values in order to ensure stability. The source of disorder for Coyne was, as for Marat, modern individualism and the ideas that Jean-Jacques Rousseau had unfortunately sown in young Vietnamese minds across the land. Coyne and de Gaulle were convinced that a return to Confucian values in the monarchy could attract popular support in the countryside and ensure stability in these troubled times. For Coyne, the monarchy was the most perfect form of government. Coyne shared Marat's critique of democracy and agreed that the monarchy was the manifestation of a nationalisme intégral, or a deep nationalism. Like Pasquier and Sereau, de Gaulle approved of the resurrection of a monarchical government based in Hue and made Pham Coyne Minister of the Interior. But once again, this project went nowhere, not least because the Confucian Son of Heaven was uninterested and not prepared to be a dupe. Bao Dai kept de Gaulle at bay, avoiding imperial tours designed to increase his prestige among the people. More importantly, the monarchy had no chance of success as a counter-revolutionary device As long as the French refused either to unite the kingdom they had truncated or to endow its indigenous sovereign with some semblance of power. De Caux authorized the use of the word Vietnam to manipulate patriotic sentiments and increased salaries for Indochinese civil servants to win over their continued support, but Vietnam remained divided, and the Vietnamese elite had even less of a voice in the colony than under the Third Republic. De Caux's team may have marched tens of thousands of Vietnamese youngsters across Indochina shouting, "Maréchal, nous voilà! Marshal, we are here!" But the Japanese, Cao Dai and Hoa Hao, did so too. And it all rang hollow for now middle-aged Vietnamese nationalists, not least of all for the champion of the Vietnamese youth and the man Vichy let die in a Paolo Condor prison cell on the 15th of August, 1943, Nguyen An Ninh. Things were different in Laos and Cambodia, where the French promoted for the first time a policy of Franco-Lao and Franco-Cambodian collaboration in order to contain the ties. Undeterred by Bao Dai's passive resistance, De Caux turned to a dynamic young Cambodian prince named Norodom Sihanouk. He made him king of Cambodia in 1941 and then sent him out of the palace and across the countryside. Through a series of carefully orchestrated imperial tours, the young emperor cast his gaze upon his people as they were invited to look upon him. If Bao Dai detested these tours in Vietnam, Sihanouk never forgot this lesson in modern kingship and its nationalist power. In fact, he would turn it against his colonial overlords in 1953, when a journalist asked him in the 1960s if the Vichy years had influenced him in any way. Sihanouk responded, "Yes, strangely enough again, it was thanks to Admiral De Caux, I have to say. From the moment I ascended to the throne, he pushed me to visit my kingdom in order to know it and to be closer to its people. I admit that at least on this matter, he provided good counsel." The Governor-General also traveled to Luang Prabang to meet King Sisavang Vong. In a move to counter further Thai claims to Lao territories, De Caux entrusted to the king the administration of the amalgam of Lao kingdoms and military territories which the French had colonized at the turn of the century. In fact, De Caux allowed Sisavang Vong to rule over an increasingly unified Lao territorial body, one we recognize today as Laos, but one which had never existed as such in the past. Significantly, the same governor-general refused to the Nguyen emperor in Annam that which he had just accorded to the Lao one in Luang Prabang, the right to rule over a unified Vietnam, one which had, in fact, existed, if only for a few decades, before the French arrived. The end of the Second World War and the birth of a new Vietnam. The 9th of March coup and the Vietnamese race for power. Like Pétain's French state in Europe, De Caux's colonial one in Asia did not survive the war. By mid-1943, both the Germans and the Japanese were in trouble. The Soviet counteroffensive into Eastern Europe and the Allied landing in Normandy in mid-1944 liberated France from German occupation and allowed Charles de Gaulle to declare and run the provisional government of the French Republic. Like his predecessors, de Gaulle was sensitive to the strategic importance of empire. In his radio address from London in 1940, he had already insisted that France does not stand alone. She is not isolated. Behind her stands a vast empire. Indeed, once liberated by the Allies in late 1942, Algeria had become the French home to de Gaulle's government in exile. As the leader of liberated France itself from mid-1944, de Gaulle now had to show the Allies that his new government was determined to fight the Axis powers. It was crucial to validating de Gaulle's claim to Indochina. And that Roosevelt had been talking of placing Indochina under an international trusteeship made this all the more important. De Caux, however, balked at the idea of fighting the